Okay, well, thank you all very much for coming. I have the honour today to be interviewing the delightful Meg Gardner. And I must admit, trailing through her website and various other places looking for her own dirty secrets has been an interesting and enlightening experience. But to give you a little bit of background, Meg is the author. Her seventh novel will be out in June, I believe it is. That's mm-hmm. The Memory Collector. She has just won the Edgar Award for Best Paperback Original for China Lake, for which... And also the Romantic Times Award for the Dirty Secrets Club for Best Procedural. Mm-hmm. And you had an interesting time at the Romantic Times convention, you said.
I did. Well, unlike a crime fiction convention such as this, where everybody sits around very seriously all day long and then retires to the bar to spend hours discussing politics or sports.
Philosophy,
yes. I discovered when I went to the Romantic Times Book Lovers Convention in Orlando, Florida, that there were about 1,500 rabid readers, 99.9% women, who were there. They were so into buying books that FedEx had a room set up to ship the boxes back to them at home. And when the day was done, people would come up to me and they'd say, "So, are you going to the fairy ball tonight?" I said, "What?" They said, "Are you going to the fairy ball?" And they would bring out these costumes they'd have that had giant wings and sparkly...
I hope you wore your wings, babe, because I did.
Were you there?
I wasn't there. I was there last year in Pittsburgh.
I didn't.
I wore my wings.
I didn't have my wings, and I didn't know. I wouldn't have known whether to be a good or an evil fairy. The next night, there was a vampire ball, which basically involved a lot of people dressing in courts, very tight corsets and with a little blood dripping, and they had all the male models who posed for the covers of these books were there in the Mr. Romance contest, I guess, and they were playing some sort of musical chairs where when the music stopped, the women ran and sat on their laps.
Meg was telling me that Barry Eisler was looking very nervous at this point.
Yes, he was. But it was a great time.
So let's rewind a little. Okay. We'll go right back to sort of early time. You were interested in writing from quite an early age, I think.
Oh,
and you were writing, you said, and you went off doing a paper for your class, and you got a ride with the sheriff's department.
Oh, when I was in high school, yeah. This is a story about Dos Pueblos High School. I've discovered I have a classmate here, or someone who went to the same high school as I did. They had a program called Citizens on Patrol. Which meant that students could spend a day riding along with the sheriff's department. And I thought, okay, instead of like spending the day in the library at school, if I could spend a day out riding around with the sheriff's deputy, that sounded like a whole lot more fun. So I agreed to do this. And they had promised several things. They had promised that that they would pick you up at 7 in the morning, they would bring you back by 5 p.m., and they promised that every citizen who went on patrol would be perfectly safe. So when the sheriff's deputy came at 7 a.m. to pick me up, he shook my father's hand and said, "Don't worry, sir, your daughter will be perfectly safe." And he shook my mother's hand and said, "Mrs. Gardner, your daughter will be perfectly safe. If there is ever the slightest sign of danger, we are instructed to pull over at the nearest restaurant or someplace and let your child out, and we will come back and pick them up later on when the danger is past." So my mother said, "That's fine, sir. Thank you very much." I got in the car and drove off, and of course you could see the neighbors all around looking and seeing Meg being taken away in a sheriff's car, and they presumed that those Gardner kids had finally got what was coming to them. Well, we spent the day driving around, hearing the cops talk about how most of their life involved paperwork. It was just, they were mostly desk-bound. It was pretty much tedium. Every time they made an arrest, they had to spend blah, 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 how many hours, filling out the paperwork. The big excitement seemed to be that this deputy arrested a soldier who had gone AWOL from his unit. And I said, "How on earth did you know that he was AWOL?" He said, because he was walking across the parking lot in uniform, he said he had on white gym socks. He said soldiers don't wear white gym socks with their uniform. He was out of uniform. This guy had gone home and pulled some white gym socks out of his cupboard. So we got to go to the jail, and that was very exciting. And I was thinking, okay, this is turning out to be a pretty good day. And then we drove around some more, and the radio went and it said there was a 211 in progress at the Wells Fargo Bank in the Fairview Shopping Center. And 211 is, in California Penal Code, is armed robbery. And so all of a sudden this guy just like puts his foot to the floor and goes tearing off down through this, you know, suburban area, about a mile from where I live, goes pulling into this parking lot in this shopping center where there's, you know, the big Safeway where, you know, I always go to get potato chips or something. And I look over and there's the Wells Fargo Bank, and there's like 9 cop cars, and there's a sheriff's deputy with a shotgun, and he's like got his back up against the wall, and he's like inching his way toward the door. And I'm thinking, okay, what did he tell my parents? And so he looks over at me, he says, get out, go around behind the car, stand behind the trunk, behind the boot, he goes, and crouch down and stay there till I come back. And I said, okay. So I jumped out of the car and I ran around back, and by now I'm feeling like I'm in, I don't know what was on TV at the time, you know, I don't know, Hill Street Blues or something. And I go back, I like hunch down behind the back of the car, and the guy gets his, like unlocks his own shotgun and runs up to join the rest of the deputies that are up at this bank, slowly moving in on it. And I'm crouching down there thinking, oh my God, what's going to happen? This is a real thing. There's an armed robbery in progress. And all of a sudden I hear behind me, Meg? I look around. And there's my mother standing behind me with her supermarket cart, with her supermarket trolley. She goes, what are you doing? I said, I'm crouching down here so I'll be safe and I won't get shot by the armed robbers. Because, of course, she'd been over at the grocery store right behind us, and she'd come out and, you know, seen all this going on, and there I was just crouched down like a fool. So that kind of made it a whole absurdist sort of thing. It turned out that there wasn't actually an armed robbery. There was a fault with the alarm system in the bank. So when all the tellers looked up and they saw, you know, a dozen sheriff's deputies outside armed with the pump action shotguns, they were pretty much scared to death themselves. But my mother really didn't want me to get back in the car with the sheriff and go away. But I wanted to finish my day with him. So that's probably why I decided that crime would be a thing that I would enjoy writing, and that it would probably have like a lot of absurd twists in any kind of story that I told, because it seems like it turned out that way in real life.
But did this also have anything to do with your father trying to talk you out of being a writer? Because he was an English professor. So.
He was. No, he would have. He might. He never even talked me. He would have tried to talk me out of being a sheriff's deputy. But no. Okay. My dad, he taught English literature at the University of California. And when I was finishing college, he said, so what are you thinking about doing? And I said, you know, like, I'm really interested in being a writer. He said, well, that's great. He said, you could be a writer if you want, and in 5 years you'll probably be working on your first novel and waiting tables, and you can tell everybody you're an unemployed novelist. He said, or you might do that other thing you're thinking about, which is going to law school, in which case in 5 years you'll be a lawyer who's got a paycheck, and you might be working on your first novel. So I thought, you know, he's not a stupid guy, and so that's what I did. But I did eventually escape from the practice of law.
So you studied law at Stanford.
I did.
And you practiced in LA, but mm-hmm. How long ago did you move to the UK?
I moved to the UK at the very end of 1994 with my husband's job for a 2-year assignment. So for the high-tech firm that can't count, and so we're still here, but no complaints.
And your early writing was travel writing. I've got some wonderful titles of some of the travelogues that Meg was writing. Hitchhiking in Lion Country is one. Stupid Things I Have Done in Zambia, including Damn That Cliff Is Steep, and With the Kids at the Petting Zoo. Tell me a little bit about this.
Well, you know, when we moved here, I didn't have a full-time office job. And we were able to travel, and we did go to, well, you read the list of what the stupid things I did in Africa. When we went to South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Zambia with our kids who were very young at the time. And hitchhiking in Lion Country was what we did when we needed to get a ride back into Victoria Falls and our ride didn't show up. And so after we were standing out on the road there with our thumbs out for a while, we kind of thought, you know, maybe doing this in the middle of a game park isn't like the most thing I really want to tell my mother about our trip when we get back. If you are in Southern Africa, I mean, the scenery is absolutely spectacular. We went to Victoria Falls, but it's also not Disneyland. They don't have on the Zambian side. They don't have railings over the edge of the cliff, and you don't want to back up with your camera too far to make sure that everybody gets in the frame. And my husband, for years, had promised the children that you know someday he would take them to the cobra petting zoo.
Does he have something against you?
No. This was just being ridiculous. He said, yes, we'll go to the zoo, and maybe they'll have the cobra petting zoo. They have the reptile house. Maybe there's the cobra petting zoo. Well, when we went to Zimbabwe, I went whitewater rafting, and he took the children into the town, and there was a reptile house. So he decided to take the kids to see the lizards and so forth. And they went in, and he realized it was somebody's backyard. And he'd put a bunch of snakes in terrariums. And my son came around the corner, who's about 6 years old at the time, and he looked around, and my husband saw my son standing in front of this terrarium where all of a sudden a cobra came up and went like this, you know. And all that was between Nate and this cobra was like 3 millimeters of glass and some scotch tape to cover the cracks. So,
okay.
That's when he said, don't tell mommy about this trip.
But, oh, okay.
But they couldn't resist, so.
So when did you actually start writing your first crime novel? You know, what made you decide to write crime in the first place?
Well, probably like a lot of crime authors, I love to read crime. I'm a crime addict. I initially loved Elmore Leonard, Sue Grafton, a lot of novelists that just the suspense, the tension, everything just grabbed me. And I thought, if I love this, that's what I should write. Also, probably when I was a teenager, I know I tried to write romance and science fiction, and it was really, really bad. It was some pretty horrible attempts, so I thought that maybe I would try a different genre.
Oh, you see, these will be dragged out of a loft somewhere and put on eBay before you know it.
Actually, I do have a friend. I did write a romantic novel when I was 16. And like most 16-year-olds, I thought that I knew everything about romance, which tells you how bad the novel was going to be to begin with. But I did know that I needed to make it exciting. So I decided to set it at the most exciting place I could think of at the time, which was at the Indianapolis 500 car race. The thing was that I didn't know how to write. So I'd write like a chapter, and this, you know, the heroine, since it was a romantic novel, she'd fall in love. And after about 30 pages, I didn't know what should happen next. So then I'd have the hero like get into his car and drive into a wall at 200 miles an hour and, you know, he'd crash and burst into flames and die. And then, you know, the heroine would mourn, and then she'd go on and pick herself up, and she'd, you know, dust herself off, and after another 10 pages, she'd find a new love and fall in, you know, they'd get together.
So actually, this was an early serial killer novel.
Well, sort of like that, because after about page 60, I'd killed all the men in the book, and there was nothing else to write about.
So she was actually cutting the brake pipes on the
car.
Like okay.
But this is one reason also I decided that crime might be a better genre for me, because when you kill people, it advances the plot instead of just killing it.
Okay. So where did Evan Delaney come from? I mean, I love the description of her, that she's too brash for her own good, and she's on her second set of teeth. I think that's just the best description of a heroine. So where did you find her? Where did she come from?
Oh, you know, they all come dragging up out of our unconscious. But I wanted to write a story about a young woman who would be a good friend, would be, you know, a good girlfriend, a good neighbor, someone you'd like to spend time with. She would say all the things that I don't ever have the guts in my own life to say to people face to face. You know, she actually has the mouth to stand up for herself. And like we all wish, she has the quips right at her fingertips when she needs them. It's not like normal life where we think of it, you know, 2 hours after we've left the room and
on the bus on the way home.
Right.
Normally, that's
so. But you know, thought we'd give her some adventures and she can run faster than me and jump higher than me. She's younger. She's, you know, better looking. It's kind of, you know, not an alter ego in any way.
So you made her an ex-lawyer turned journalist. Why did you pick that profession particularly rather than going for a private eye or a police detective? Or
I didn't plan it to be a series.
Okay.
Initially. So I just wanted to write a novel about this woman in Santa Barbara and her family and how they inadvertently get involved with an extremist religious sect, which was the story in China Lake. And I thought, I don't really want this to be about a cop. I don't want it to be a procedural. I want it to be about an everyday woman whose family finds himself in extreme situation, and you know, how far will she go to protect her nephew, basically, and her, you know, how far would she go to protect the people she loves? So I thought, I wasn't a cop, but I was a lawyer. I could give her some background that would, she has a knowledge of the court system, and she can sound like she knows what she's doing before she gets into too much trouble. And she, like, has wild ferrets chasing her around and things like that.
So does the inspiration for this come in any way? You said at one point you had an armed robber ringing up and asking about your daughter.
It didn't come from that. That's another of the kind of absurd things that happened in my life. That is not about writing. That was about, I was on television a number of years ago. I was on a quiz show. I was on Jeopardy in the U.S., if Americans know that. And when you're on Jeopardy, of course, they put up your name, and they put up the amount of how much prize money you've gotten, et cetera, et cetera. And one thing that prisoners have time to do is watch a lot of television. And so one day I got a call, saying, hello, we've got such and such calling the law firm, looking for a lawyer. So I took the call, and it turned out that this was a guy who was a convict calling me from U.S. federal prison in Missouri. And he wanted to talk about, when he was getting out, and he'd seen me on the television, and, he'd heard me mention that I had, but by the time he started saying, and I heard you say you have a little girl. Uh-oh. Yeah. So I hung up and called back and talked to the warden, and he said, no, the guy is not about to get out. He's serving a 15 to 20 year sentence for armed robbery. And I said, oh, what did he rob? And he also wanted to marry me, he said he robbed a U.S. mail truck. He robbed a postal service truck, naked. So that's why he was in federal prison.
Okay.
So I'm on their list of people to notify when this fella actually ever does get out.
Has anyone else gone to a scary mental place there? So that first novel you wrote with Evan Delaney became China Lake, mm-hmm. which came out in 2002. At what point did you decide that you would make this into a series character?
When my publisher said, would I write another one?
That's a good inspiration, yes.
And I was very happy to do it. The Hunter Staunton asked me to write another book featuring the same character, so I did, and I've so far written 5 in the series, and it's great fun, and I've really enjoyed it.
So the second book in that series is Mission Canyon mm-hmm. which came out the following year, and then Jericho Point, Crosscut, and Kill Chain. But then in 2008, you've developed a new character with Joe Beckett, who is a forensic psychiatrist. And The Dirty Secrets Club, which is a great book for all of you, those who haven't read it. Why the change of character? What made you decide after doing a certain number of books in the Evan Delaney series that you would go to Joe? I mean, presumably you're going to then come back to Evan, are you?
That's the plan.
So
Joe? Well, there's the answer. There's the artist answer. There's the professional answer. There's the career answer. I love to tell stories. I didn't just want to tell stories about Evan Delaney. I wanted to tell stories about other people set in other places, and Jo is quite a different person, and she lives in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Second, I thought, if there's so many writers that write great series, but, they get 10, 15, 20 books in a series, and that's what everybody knows them for, and readers can get really upset if you want to switch and write something different. So I thought, maybe before I get to that point, I'll start another series so that people have different things in mind for me, and so I love CSI, but I didn't think I needed to write another something about we didn't need another character who goes around with tweezers out on the road and picks up disgusting little bits of something or other and puts it in a plastic bag, and I wanted to write about the emotional side behind a lot of these cases, and that's what a forensic psychiatrist does. And this is a real profession. The forensic psychiatrists do psychological autopsies when people have died and the police and the medical examiner can't figure out why, how. They determine whether a death is natural, accidental, suicide, or homicide. They have to inventory the person's life, go through their medical history, psychiatric history, find out if they had enemies. And they do have, they're the ones that are the last resort in the tricky cases. Like, and I talked to a real forensic psychiatrist, he said, do you have cases like somebody stepped off a curb in front of a bus? Downtown San Francisco. Was that an accident? Was it suicide? Did somebody push him? It's up to the psychiatrist. Even shootings. Were they cleaning the gun or were they ending it all? So that's what they get to do.
She has a very interesting background, and you integrate the backstory very nicely into the Dirty Secrets Club. with the trauma she's had in her past, which had brought her to this point. Was that a conscious decision when you set out, or was that just, you know, the way the book started to come together?
Oh, a little of both. Jo's got, I mean, she doesn't have super secrets, but she's lost her husband, and she's trying to get past that, and she doesn't really want to talk about it a whole lot. But of course, in this book, there are people who are trying to drag it all up again and bring up a very painful and unresolved issue. And of course, her husband died in a helicopter accident, and so she has to deal with the rescue services who were there that day. And by the way, it's really fun to go down and visit the pararescue, the Air National Guard pararescue service down, and get them to take you around and show you all their toys, all their jet skis and their skydiving equipment, and show you how they spend, you know, time on skis and underwater and scuba diving and everything. So,
and this is all in the name of work,
yes.
Obviously, both for you and for them.
Right. Yes.
Research is just the most fun. But I think, just in case anybody thinks that this book is, you know, too serious, at one point she is chasing a monkey around her house with a samurai sword. So that's a very nice point in the book, I thought.
Well, I mean, like, things happen. I mean, you have a neighbor who's a hypochondriac, and he gets himself a helper monkey. But of course, the helper monkey doesn't actually help. It mostly causes problems for Joe. So,
okay, so tell us a little bit about your sort of the way you write. You were saying that your husband is your first test reader after you finish the books, but you don't let him read them while you're actually writing them.
No, and I explained to Zoe that I don't let my husband read it while we're writing, because it's not very good for marital harmony, which probably goes back to him peeking over my shoulder at some point and then having me, I don't know, punch him or something. You know, it's a mix. You try to come up with a character and with an idea, and you start thinking, especially if you're writing suspense, like, what's out there? What's bothering people? What is what's in the news? What gets under our skin? What scares us? Because I think if it scares me, then it's there's a good chance it'll scare readers too. So I try to develop it from that. And of course, there's a lot of back and forth with editors if they say, "Oh my God, that, you know, that they're too nice to say that stinks." But you know, 90% of when you're writing, you're basically taking spaghetti, and that's your ideas, and you're throwing it against the wall and seeing what sticks. And, you know, 90% of it slides off, and the little bit that sticks is, you know, the starting point for your story, and then you populate it and expand it out and come up with all those little twists that you try to find.
And this is something to bear in mind if anybody's ever invited for dinner at Meg's house. So you've said the worst thing about writing for you is the first draft.
Yeah, I don't know. A lot of writers love the first draft. They say they just sit down at the keyboard, and, you know, the ideas flow. And you even hear writers, I don't know about you, I hear writers say, "Oh, you know, the characters just take over. They just, you know, the characters come to life inside my head, and they just take over, and it all pours out." And I think, you know, okay, maybe you need to up your medication a little bit if you really have the characters just taking over. But I don't find that at all. I find that it's actually just work, that I have to make sure that everybody doesn't sound like me, because in a thriller, it's not good if you've got 12 characters and they all sound like they're, you know, like white women who grew up in Southern California. But you have to make sure that they actually sound like individual people, and that they talk their own way, and that they have their own backgrounds, and that the bizarre things happen to them, and they haven't been killed off the same way that somebody was killed off in 100 other books. You have to come up with a creative way of having horrible things happen to them, and then it starts to get fun.
So, and you obviously enjoy doing the research for the books. What's the sort of strangest piece of research you think you've been at, apart from going playing with paramedic helicopters?
And that was only about the equipment and the mission. It wasn't about the fact that they were all about 27 years old and, like, in extremely good shape. It was just
a side benefit. Yeah.
I didn't call it research at the time, but going in a jet boat on the Zambezi River above Victoria Falls turned into research, because that has now become a scene in my next novel, and one of the opening scenes in The Memory Collector. Because you're out there and you get in this boat and you go out on this huge river, and the captain says, "No, do not worry, we are above the falls, but we will not go close to the falls." "Okay, we will go close to the falls, but you see this boat, it has a Chevy Hemi engine, 350 horsepower. It is fine. This is a very reliable boat. And this is another time you're thinking, okay, I'm in the middle of this river with my three children, and I'm trusting that this guy actually does have 350 reliable horsepower at the back of this boat, that he's going to be able to turn us around and get us out of there. And this is the point at which a thriller writer starts thinking, okay, when I get back to shore, I'm going to write it all down. Where other people might just sit there and bite their fingernails. Because once you get, by the way, once you get known as, I'm sure this happens to you, once you get known as a crime writer, a thriller writer, people start to look at you funny. They look at you like, what's on her mind? What's she thinking about? Well, she's looking at me. I was in New York last year with a friend, and we were at one of those hotels that's got an atrium, it's got the lifts, the elevators that go up, the glass enclosed elevators, and I was watching one go up and down. And she looked over and she goes, you're figuring out how to throw somebody out of that and kill him, aren't you? I said, yeah.
Yeah, you do have to be a little bit careful what you say at these things. I remember going to Left Coast Crime in El Paso a few years ago. There was a big discussion going on there about whether it was okay in crime books to kill children and animals. And at what age does a child become kind of fair game, you know? And we all got into an elevator one morning, and I think it was Reese Bowen, climbed in and looked around the people who were already there and said, ah, I've discovered it's all right to kill children when they get to about 13. Now, there were two people in the lift who had nothing to do with the convention, and they got out very quickly at the next floor. So, yes, you do have to be a little bit careful. You go in asking questions, knowing you're writing a novel,
right.
But the people you're asking the questions of often don't quite realize that.
And you know it's never okay to kill the animals. If you ever kill a puppy, then people will hound you for the rest of your life.
Pun intended.
That's right, yes. No, I have been out in public also and talking about characters, and people have not realized that's who I'm talking about, and I've been told off. So, tell you, oh, you're a horrible person. That boy obviously needs to be, needs rehab. He doesn't need to have you two women talking about him in such a terrible, terrible fashion.
But you've said that you consider no subject is off limits.
Did I say that?
You did. I have it written down here, so it must be true. Oh hang on, we make stuff up.
No, I think I meant that if we start censoring ourselves and thinking that there's some topics that are too politically sensitive or uncomfortable, then we start to make our work bland, and then it becomes inauthentic. I think we have to have the chance to write honestly about any subject we want. We shouldn't be afraid of pushing boundaries or making reviewers or politicians or anybody mad at us.
So you've also said that you explore the boundary between morality and wrongdoing, and when is it justified to go outside the law? Now, I think your Evan, particularly the Evan character, kind of pushes those boundaries a little, doesn't she?
Well, yeah. I mean, having practiced law, I think every lawyer knows that there's law, there's the justice system, and then there's right and wrong, and those things don't always line up exactly. So, I wanted to in the novels. I think you would. I heard you say earlier today that people's character is revealed by the tough choices they make. And I wanted, especially in a suspense novel, in a thriller where big things are happening, people's lives are threatened, their families might be in danger. They get to the point where they have to make the biggest, toughest decisions of their life. Will they risk somebody's life? Would they risk a child? Would they risk, heaven forbid, a puppy? At what point does doing what's right become something that's not necessarily legal? And are they willing to cross that line? So.
So no subject is off limits for you. We were having the violence debate this morning. Where do you stand on that?
My books have some graphic violence in them. Not all of them are terribly graphic. There are a couple. Crosscut has some graphic violence in it, but violence can be very useful. As I've also heard Zoe say, that there's a difference between it being gratuitous and being graphic. You don't want it just to be there, just to have people eat it up like popcorn and get their fill of it. Also, I find that readers can make up a whole lot more stuff than you need to put on the page. That the theater of the mind is pretty graphic on itself. If you give a hint of what's going to happen, and sometimes if you cut away, then the reader's going to fill in something really much worse than you could ever put on the page. It's like in the science fiction movies, like think back to the 50s, the horrible movies, Them, or everything where they had like giant bees and or grasshoppers. You don't necessarily have to see the thing. It's sometimes a lot creepier if it's just hinted at, and then people's own dark imaginations take over and fill in the blanks.
Usually much worse than anything you could have come up with. So I have to ask, one of the little snippets that I discovered about Meg, one of the many little snippets I discovered, tell us about being a mime.
Where did I? Yeah, I know. I said something like that. I was I was a mime in high school. My high school had. Oh, you're frowning at me like, what kind of a high school did you go to? It was not the Marcel Marceau Academy of Paris. It was a state school, public school in California. But, you know, you get involved with the theater department, and I couldn't sing, so I wasn't going to be doing musicals. They did have a mime troupe. So, you know, the guy I had a crush on when I was 14 was in that. So I joined the mime troupe, which meant I spent a lot of time hiding my acne behind the white face and learning how to pretend like, you know, you're stuck in a box or you're walking against the wind. Actually, the only time that it got me in trouble was when we used to go and perform at grade schools or other high schools or at retirement homes, and we were coming back from a retirement home, and we were actually coming back from the same Fairview Shopping Center where that near armed robbery had been, and we had stopped at the Baskin Robbins and gotten ourselves some ice cream, and driving back toward high school, and saw the lights of the sheriff's car in the rearview mirror, and they pulled us over because they thought that we were masked robbers in white face. Of course, us there with our ice cream cones and our Dos Pueblos High School sticker on the back of the car. But
Clearly dangerous criminals, yes.
This was all before mimes became annoying. This is back when it was just fun, and it wasn't like people like went out of their way to try to run them down at a park. We didn't have a little beret we sat out and busked for money or anything like that.
I knew, the last BouchyCon, Mark Billingham was telling a story about a guy who tried to do stand-up comedy, and the first 5 minutes of his act he tried to do through the medium of mime. And there was a guy at the back eventually who sort of shouted out, "Can you speak up?" And after another couple of minutes, when this didn't deter him, he said, "Has he gone yet?" So, okay, what's the excuse for going to the Star Trek exhibition in Hyde Park in costume?
No excuse. I had a friend who invited me to go to the Star Trek exhibition in Hyde Park, and I said, "Sure, I love Star Trek." And it was only when we got there that she pulled up, opened the backpack, and she said, "You're such a good friend. You get to be Captain Kirk." And she handed me the captain's shirt. So she brought the big ears that she put on. So I felt that I got out of that and you know, like looking pretty normal.
So is this the kind of thing you're tempted to put in a book? Or is there anything that's happened to you that you think, if I put this in a book, nobody would believe this?
Oh, all the time. But no, nobody dresses. Actually, maybe somebody could dress up as a Klingon. Actually, now somebody did dress up as a Klingon in the Dirty Secrets Club, now that I think about it. Yes. And Evan Delaney does have Star Trek underwear. But it says Resistance is Futile on it. But other than that, that's as far as I've gone with the Trek. We don't need to get more involved.
I really like this girl. Yeah, she's my kind of character. So you said you don't let your husband read the books till you finish the first draft. Are you a plotter? Do you kind of wing it? Do you do several drafts before you let anybody see it? What's your kind of process? How do you go about it?
I do plot my novels out. That's because I tried writing without doing it, and I got so lost. I was you know, like way up a creek without a paddle, and I had no idea how to get back. I just wrote myself into a corner and was stuck to the point where I put whatever it was I was writing in a drawer and locked it away. I hear some writers talk. I know James Lee Burke says that you know, he just sits down and he starts to write. He has a couple of characters, he has an idea in his head, and he never knows what's going to happen more than a scene or two ahead, and he gets all the way to the end of the book that way. But I can't do that. I'm not as organized as Jeffrey Deaver, who plots every single scene out from beginning to end, so he knows exactly what happens at every single page of the book. But I need to know. I need to know the beginning, and you know, and some of the things in the middle of it. You don't want to suck all the life out of it by writing an outline form for you know like you would in school for something. But it really helps me to know where the people are going to end up. So
Now, a couple of years ago, well, 2006, you had an amazing review from Stephen King for one of your books. He actually said her five novels are, simply put, the finest crime suspense series I've come across in the last 20 years, which for Stephen King is high praise. How did that come about, and what effect has it had since then?
It came about just absolutely serendipitously, by total coincidence. He was coming to London for a book tour, and we had the same British publisher, and I think they'd sent him a box of books, and he was looking for something to read on the flight, and I really wish I could say that he picked up my book and opened it up and read the first paragraph and thought, you know, oh my God, this is so beautiful, I can't put it down. Actually, he opened it up and he said, this is the one that has the largest print. It will be the easiest on my eyes for a long plane flight. And so he brought my book along with him. He brought Channel Lake, and he enjoyed it. And he'd finished it by the time he got to Heathrow, and he asked for more. So that was wonderful. The thing was, at the time, I didn't have a U.S. publisher. I'm an American. I'm living here. I'm sort of got this sort of like Twilight Zone career, because I didn't quite. I'm not a British writer, but I wasn't published in the U.S. And actually, by this point, you know, I'd published several books, but all my relatives at home were kind of saying, you know, like, oh yes, dear, of course you write books. You know, I'm sure they're very nice, and they'd kind of go away like this because nobody had seen them. They weren't in Borders. They weren't in Barnes and Noble, and they weren't published in the U.S., which was slightly a source of frustration for me. Mm-hmm. But then I met Stephen King, and he liked the rest of the books, which was great. And by the way, you know the scene in Misery, where his book and movie Misery, where Kathy Bates comes up and goes, "I'm your biggest fan," which is of course she's going to kidnap the protagonist and torture him and everything. That's like the worst thing any writer can ever hear from anybody, is somebody saying that, and it's really, really creepy when the person that says it to you is Stephen King doing his Kathy Bates imitation. So, I mean, he was joking, but I think I said, "Oh my God, that's alarming." So, but he was extraordinarily generous to me, and he's done this he's just a really generous person with helping other musicians, artists, writers. Because he read my books, he found out I didn't have an American publisher. He mentioned my novels on his website, and then went the extra step. He mentioned them in a column in Entertainment Weekly. Which suddenly, bizarrely, after several years of American publishers rejecting everything I submitted to them, you know, 2 days after that, like 12 publishers decided that I wasn't so bad after all. So, you know, then I got a U.S. publisher, and now I'm.
And then Edgar followed shortly afterwards. Yes, yeah. Excellent. So tell us a little about your next book is out next month. It's mm-hmm. It's another Joe Beckett. It's called The Memory Collector, and it's about anterograde amnesia. So tell us a little bit about the story of that.
Oh, yeah, Joe Beckett, her patients are all dead. Her cases, the people she deals with she usually does psychological autopsies on people who have already been dead and buried. But in this one, she has a live patient. He's a man who's got anterograde amnesia. This is short-term memory loss. It means he can't form new memories. He can remember everything about his life perfectly up until he was either injured, attacked, perhaps contaminated with some kind of substance that has destroyed the part of his brain that forms new memories. And so he can't remember things for more than about 5 minutes at a time. And this is this is a real condition. It will totally mess up your life if anything like this ever happens to you, because he doesn't even realize that he's forgetting things necessarily. You know, I could meet you and then walk out of here and can walk back in a few minutes and go, "Oh, what's your name?"
It happens to me all the time.
He never has the ability to remember what's happened to him. But the thing is, he escapes from the ER. Joe finds out that he's a former mercenary who may be going out to get revenge on some people he dislikes, and also that whatever it is that's injured him seems to be contagious. So she has to find him before other people in San Francisco, everybody who was on his flight from London, perhaps take this thing out into the city and spread it around.
Right. Does anybody have any questions for Meg? I'm going to throw it open for the last 15, 20 minutes.
In
Toby.
Your China Lake book, do you find that you've gotten any kickback from the police who you so politely talk about being so stupid and having no understanding whatsoever about what you're talking about and ignoring you entirely?
No.
Not at all.
No, not at all. I've had reviewers mention the fact that the police in China Lake, Evan's family is threatened by a rather extremist cult, and the police don't take her seriously, possibly because she's got her family, her brother's got entanglements with these people and has threatened them in the past as well. But it was fiction. I hope that the police know that somebody has to let it slip so that the heroine has a chance to
pull you over.
No, but of course I set that all in China Lake, California. You notice I live in London.
That's true.
my in-laws still live in China Lake, but I haven't been back since the book was published. And so maybe I will stay out of Kern County.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Good sense,
so.
Yeah.
Anybody else have a question for Meg?
Oh, you're shaking your head. What's wrong? Yes.
Just on your sort of working method. I mean, do you sit down each day when writing a book?
I do try to write every day, because otherwise, if you don't, then it becomes a hobby. I've learned how to write a book, like from the first idea till it's done, till it's ready to be sent to the printer. It takes about a year, and that involves a month or two of coming up with ideas, of doing the research, and then sitting down. A rough draft might take 4 or 5 months, and then there's a lot of rewriting. The real work I find is in the rewriting, to make that big pile of steaming garbage turn into something that's really publishable. But was that another part to your question, or was that it?
Yeah, that's
yeah.
Pretty much.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Apart from the weather, what would you say are the main kind of differences for you between living in California and living in London?
Not having my family here. That was the big thing, of course, because we live five miles from my parents, and the kids were used to be able to ride their bicycles over to grandma's house. But it was discovering that British people think that California is an exotic place. That was, I mean, I was talking, like I said, I know, well, I didn't realize this. And even, like I said, I met somebody who went to my high school, and we were kind of like, yeah, we all thought that Santa Barbara was sort of like an ordinary place to grow up, wasn't very exciting or anything. And then it was when I got here that I found out that the English in particular thought that California was really exotic. And actually, I found this out, after we got here, I came down with pneumonia, and nobody could figure out what had caused it. And this went on for a couple of months. That the doctors thought I had tuberculosis. They kept asking me if I had been. Yes, he knows exactly what it was. But nobody.
Spot the doctor in the audience.
Yes, I'll have you say that again in a second. Nobody knew what it was until they sent me after months to an infectious diseases specialist, who said, "Have you been anyplace exotic?" And I said, no, I just moved here from California. He goes, oh, that's what it was. And Bill, you can say that.
It's a fungal infection called coccidiomycosis, and it's found in the valley, and it's spread by dust storms. And a lot of population in California, in that particular area we're talking about, have coccidiomycosis.
Yes, it was this fungal form of pneumonia, like aspergillus. And there were two things we think caused it. It takes a long time to manifest. But one was that there had been several earthquakes in the area. I lived near an agricultural area. Earthquakes raise a lot of dust, which got into the house. The second was, before we moved, I had cleaned my house. I had vacuumed. I had dusted. I had dusted the blinds and the curtains. And that's probably how I inhaled it. So this is actually a cautionary tale for everybody, that housework is dangerous, it's toxic, and it should be avoided at all costs.
Well, you do it, and 6 months later, it all needs doing again.
So that's how I found out that California was seen as being exotic, and I have a foreign accent.
Well, you described Southern California as the Taco Bell School of Architecture, didn't you?
Well, yeah. Yes.
Sorry, yes.
Just a comment. California is portrayed on TV over here as being exotic. There's an advert going around now on the television.
Right.
That makes it exotic.
Well, with Rob Lowe and Arnold Schwarzenegger and everybody, come on out to California. But yeah, that's how we all live every day,
right,
down at the beach with our surfboard.
Anywhere that's got sunshine is exotic.
You can't quite see CSI Scunthorpe, though, can you? It doesn't quite have that ring to it.
Yeah.
So, anyone?
Do you still read a lot of other crime fiction? What's your particular favourite? And can you read whilst you're actually writing your own novel?
I love to read crime fiction. I read a lot of crime fiction when I'm in the early stages of writing a novel, because if I get too deep into my novel, I don't want to like be influenced by what somebody else is writing, either their style, their voice, plot twist, or anything. But I do read a lot of crime fiction when I'm in between books or just thinking up in the main stages. Elmore Leonard, I think, is just a genius. I love James Lee Burke. Sue Grafton, Janet Ivanovich, Carl Hyacin, who was the one that I read when I thought that, you know, oh my God, if he can get away with this stuff in a book like this, then you can do anything in a crime novel. Michael Connelly, I could go on and on and on, but I'll stop there.
Okay. Oh. Yeah.
What did you read when you were a child?
A young child, yeah. Winnie the Pooh, Misty of Chicoteague, Nancy Drew, a lot of Nancy Drew novels about the girl detective. And then by the time I was in high school, Madeleine L'Engle, I don't know if this is...
Yeah.
And then in high school, I started reading pretty much espionage books and thrillers and Let the Ponies Go by the Wayside. But the Black Stallion, now I'm getting really... When I was in grade school, I had to read all the Black Stallion books. I thought they were fabulous.
Yeah, the horse did it in everyone.
No.
Yes. Yes, you
could. You ever be persuaded to write another session?
I could be persuaded, and I have my price, so. Sure. I have given some thought to it. Actually, in one of my novels, there's a section set in the UK, in Kilchain. Evan, her father is kidnapped, and she ends up going around the world to try to help recover him. So she starts out in Southern California, and she goes to Thailand, and then she comes to London. For me, that was fun because, of course, I wrote it as like an American being, you know, what would happen to an American dumped down in London, and she's got culture shock and everything. So it's kind of, I hope that both the British and American audiences would recognize the American having culture shock there. It would be harder for me to write a novel with a British protagonist set in the UK because I'm still figuring you all out, you know. So, yeah.
Just don't write one like Elizabeth George, that's all.
Oh!
Not saying you're wrong with her books, but she just does not get England or Britain at all.
Okay.
No, I wanted to ask you about your blogging, because you do blog, and unlike some authors, your blog seems to be very much sort of personal blog, if you like. You're not particularly blogging to promote books, which, for example, on Penguin website, somebody does a guest blog every week.
Right.
Your blog is Lying for a Living?
Yeah. It was my editors and agents who suggested that I start the blog, so there's that relationship. And I have written for the Penguin blog, but then when I do that, it is when the book is coming out and I'm specifically writing about the book. I mean, I think if you're going to write a blog or Facebook or something else, you're doing it for your own reasons, and I wanted to do it to connect with readers, not just to talk about writing or... my characters. If you start to just blag yourself to try to sell yourself through your blog, people are going to feel like they're getting a sales pitch, and that's not fun. You have to give them something else. And so I ended up, you know, like I didn't know what a blog was going to be. I didn't know what I was going to talk about. Maybe talk about how I drafted this or did research or something. And instead, I ended up doing things like writing about what happened when I tried to go to Harrogate last summer and I couldn't get a seat on the train, and I made up this whole story about how I knocked down the Girl Scouts and the Pilgrims from Lourdes, and then the nuns came after me, and then this is another blogger here in the audience, by the way. So somehow, I find in the comments she's written back that like she hears that Sister Mary Ignatius has a ferocious left hook and all this kind of stuff. So it just kind
of...
I don't know. I guess a lot of them are readers. I don't know most of these people. You're one of the few people I get to see face to face.
You wrote a post once about having been at a book signing recently, and you met one of your commenters there.
Yes.
At a book signing. And is it a way to...
It is a way to... Well, I think a blog is kind of like... It's not just a column. It's more like a conversation with where you can have back and forth with people you might never have met. They might be in Singapore or Toronto or whatever. But you know, it's been really great, because when I did have gone out on tours around places, then you know, people who live nearby have been able to stop in and say hello, which is a great treat for me. But
the gentleman at the back, I think you had a question.
If you say you saw me perform with the mime troupe, I'm going to just die.
Especially when you had only a UK publishing contract, when you were writing, were you writing for a UK audience or a US audience, or do you see a difference in how you would write to different kinds of audiences?
Yes and no. When I wrote my first book, I had no idea where it was going to be published. I just wrote it. So I wrote it as a Californian set, with a book set in California. It was initially published in the UK. And at the end, and in a lot of other countries in the English-speaking world, but I did find out at that point, everybody who didn't grow up in Santa Barbara doesn't know what the CHP is, or what Caltrans is. So I have to explain that the California Highway Patrol, or you know, the people who repair the freeways, and kind of be aware of how like some lingo slang won't translate or whatever, and I might need to explain a little bit more fully to another audience what life is like in California. Also, it made me realize that, of course, if people think that California is exotic, I can kind of just like play this up to the hilt and, you know, make California seem like this, you know, Disneyland free-for-all, Charlie's Angels, you know, phantasmagoria where we all run around in bikinis and drive dune buggies in Malibu, you know, 24/7.
You mean
that.
It's not like that?
Of course it is, Zoe.
Oh. So. Another illusion shattered. Yes, I know. Are your books altered for the UK now they're out in the US? Have the publishers altered them at all, or
nope.
They come out exactly?
They come out exactly as
just with the spellings.
Nope,
altered.
Even the spellings. My British publisher had told me that they were going to honor the American spelling.
Evan's parents have a unique relationship. Is this personal, or is this something you just made up?
I just made it up. Totally.
Okay,
no, my parents had a very long and happy marriage, and I have a very long and happy marriage. Evan Delaney's parents in the novels are divorced. They said they were married 22 years. They've been divorced 13. They barely speak, except every year they go on a cruise. They take an exotic vacation together every year. They can deal with each other for 2 weeks a year in international waters. So that's what they do.
Any last question?
What was the background to Jesse, Evan's on-off fiancé?
Right. Evan's fiancé. Jesse is Evan's. Jesse Blackburn is Evan's boyfriend, and he is disabled. I presume that's what you're asking about. He's also a lawyer. He's also a big mouth. He's also a. He was. I didn't initially plan to make him her boyfriend. He was just going to be a character in a story that she knew and helped out. You know, I write these crime novels. Evan's not a cop. She's not a special forces soldier. She doesn't carry a gun, but she's involved with a lot of criminal cases. And I thought I wanted to have a life where crime has had an impact on her life. And so Jesse was a world-class athlete. He was a champion swimmer. He had the world at his feet. He was young, handsome. He was going to law school. He was brilliant. He was just like, the world was laid out before him like a banquet. And then out of the blue, he was run down by a hit-and-run driver. And his best friend was killed, and he was left disabled and had to figure out how to go on with everything that he'd known taken away from him. So that's the impact of violent crime on their life. It's something that they don't want to dwell on, but it's always there in the background. It's never going to go away. It colors the way that they see the world. And I also didn't want them to be people who could just laugh off you know, terrible violence with a, you know, like with a yippee-ki-yay, kind of Bruce Willis quip. I wanted them to have a real sense of how bad it was out there. But you know, I also thought, you know, like, she likes this guy, it shouldn't matter to her, you know, what's going on with him. So that's where it came up from.
Right, I believe we are almost out of time. Yes, right. Okay, I just have two final little points. There is a raffle. I hope you've all bought your raffle tickets. There are some wonderful prizes, MP3 players and Bristol Blue Glass. The raffle is benefiting the RNIB, so please go purchase lots of tickets. And also, starting about now, is the launch of the Criminal Tendencies Anthology, which is downstairs in the club lounge. Please all go along. It's in benefit of breast cancer charities, so please let's see you all there. And it just leaves me to say thank you very much, Meg.
Well, thank you, Zoe, for very much.
Great
it's
fun.
Fun. I appreciate it. Thank
and
you all for coming.
Meg will be signing next door, Foreman Orderly Queue.